Hello, this is Melissa. It is Real History, and today is the 21st of March, 2024, and I am talking today with Laura. Hello, Laura.
Hi, Melissa.
How are you?
I'm doing well today. Thank you.
Do you want to tell anybody where you live or what the weather's like or anything like that?
I live in Ohio, central Ohio, around Columbus, Ohio, and the weather today is very, very cold. It's very windy. We had some flurries off and on today. Yeah, winter's back.
Well, that's not fun.
No, not at all. Well, we just had, you know, like 70-degree weather a few days ago.
We were talking the other day, and we were both agreeing that we had experienced days where you had all four seasons in one day. Just this craziness.
Yes, that's happened.
One thing that I notice here, I don't know about you there, but I get an awful lot of spraying here.
Here too. The skies are just gray all the time. I mean, you get spurts where there's sun shining through, but last year when I had my furniture on my patio, there was almost like a rust powder residue on my cushions. I mean, you could, you know, hit it and knock it off. But I should have kind of took a sample and tried to see what it was. And then I had a little tiny bee that was on my other cushion, and it just kind of went around in circles, and it's like I didn't know what it was doing, but it wouldn't fly off, so I just left it there. But it finally died, and it's like I don't know if there was something in the air. I'm sure there was something, because I don't have the bees or the butterflies or anything like I used to.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think there are a lot of explanations why the bee population has been declining for a couple of decades now.
Oh, yeah. Yep, that's for sure.
Yeah. Very scary to, you know, because the bees are always, it's sort of like the canary in the coal mine.
Yeah.
So do you, you know, I know that I reassured you that this was just a conversation for us that we would share with other people, you know, but I lied. I want to know if you want to just talk for just a minute about your process. I don't like the term waking up, but if you want to talk about your process of questioning the way, you know, reality as it is given to us, what your journey into seeking other kinds of alternate information and truth, that's just the simplest way of putting it.
Well, like many, you know, I found Alan, but I found Alan later in his life and in mine. And actually, I found him a few months after he had passed away, and I didn't realize that he had died until I was looking into the website, Cutting Through the Matrix, and it had a bio with his information, and at the end, you know, said he passed away. And I was like, oh my goodness. So I was wondering to myself, well, who's doing the website? You know, I'm like, is he really dead? That's what I thought at first. Then I don't know how long it was before you came out with your podcast, introducing yourself to everyone. But that's when I was like, I'm so glad that you did. And I contacted you almost immediately with an email and thanking you for that. And we just, you and I have become friends that way. And we've talked several times and for lengthy conversations. But Alan's work, which I'm so glad you're continuing, and along with your own, has opened my eyes to a lot of things. It's like, you know, people wonder, and then you wonder about, you know, the source that you're getting your information from. And I very much feel that this information that Alan talked about and passed along to people is as authentic and genuine as you can be. I feel safe, you know, listening to his talks. I feel that the truth is being spoken. So that's my journey with him. And I've just, I listen to him about every day because it just keeps me grounded and it keeps me focused on really what's going on with our world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is an interesting way of saying it, that in the present, it keeps you focused on what's going on in the world, because I feel that way too. I know there are people, and I understand this point of view. I understand this way of seeing it, is that people will say, I wish he was still here talking to us regularly and letting us know what's going on. I understand that. I do, believe me. But I also feel when I listen to a talk of his, even if it's 20 years old, that I'm still hearing what's going on right now. And it helps me. It helps, like you say, keep me focused and balanced and, paying attention to what matters. But just before we
get... Well, like you've said several times, on other talks, his talks are so pertinent to what's going on today. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like he's still here telling us.
Yes.
What's going on, yeah. In a way.
Yeah. I know what you mean. Now, before we just get into a more normal conversation, and it's funny when you say that because, I guess I just have this sense that I've been talking to you forever, I know mm-hmm. your family and I know your background and everything that's going on, and maybe not day to day in your life, but I feel up to speed with things. So it's just when you remind me that we've only been speaking for about a year and a half or so, it's like, oh, really? Is that all?
So, I know. It seems a lot longer, doesn't it?
It does.
It does to me too.
But I wanted to just say a couple of things really quickly, which is you're a youngish woman, and yet you have had a complete career, retired from your career, raised your family, and you have grandchildren. And I think one of the things that I just think is so cool about you that impresses me is that from the way that you've given me your history, is you just sort of knew at a young age what would be a sensible direction to go, and that's the direction that you went in, and then you sensibly stayed at your career, and then you sensibly were able to retire early. Well, I mean, and I don't even know if it was early, you put in a full, a full run. And your work itself, the career that you chose, speaks to an analytical, logical mind that would make those choices in life. And so if you want to talk just briefly about that, because I wanted to get from your retired before you're 60 and you look around and go, wait a minute. Things aren't as I thought they were. So if you want to fill in some of the blanks there, that'd be great.
Sure. When I was in high school, there was a couple seniors that graduated, like the year before I did. And they were working at the state, and they were in IT. So they called our teacher and said, hey, they're going to be hiring for IT. So myself and a couple other people applied and we got hired. So I started working for the state right out of high school. I mean, literally the next day after I graduated, I started.
And just for people who have been living under a rock for several decades, IT is information technologies.
Yes. So when I got notified of that job, I was at a vocational school, which was data processing. So I was kind of in that field, trying to work my way further into that field. So when I got hired, I got hired in data recording, which is basically like key punch. And I was working there not even a year yet. And I thought to myself, I don't want to do this the rest of my life, sit here and key punch. So I went to a couple bosses up and I said, hey, I want to go to school full time and work here part time because I want to go get my degree. And he said, okay. So that's what I did. For 4 years, I worked part-time and went to school full-time and got my master's in information technology. And once I got my degree, I transferred to our IT department. And that's where I was for 30 years. And I did a lot of different things in that 30 years. You know, programming, server administration, networking, project management, you name it, I've done it. It was a good job for me at the time because it was where it was starting, you know, with computers. And I wanted to make as much money as I could because that was my mindset back then, you know, and to raise a family. And that's what I did. Once I got my 30 years in, which the last 10 years, I was like, oh my gosh, I can't wait to retire. But I enjoyed my job, but I hated the politics of the state, working for the state. Uh-huh. After I retired early, I was retired at 48. But at the time, my sister was diagnosed with cancer. And so I thought, well, I'll retire, maybe hopefully be able to spend some time with her, you know, while she's going through all this cancer. But I didn't. She died the same, let's see, May. She died actually before I retired, a couple months. So that didn't work out the way I needed it to do for her or me. I wanted to spend more time with her. But that was my IT career. And when I was in IT, there was a time when I needed some extra money. And they weren't offering overtime at the time. So I thought, well, what am I going to do? So I said, I didn't want to flip hamburgers. So there was this day spa close to me. And they weren't advertising for work. But I thought, if I'm going to work somewhere, I'm going to do something I like. So I went in and asked them if they needed some help. Well, they were like, well, we'll take your name and stuff. But, you know, they kept putting me off. But I kept checking with them every week. You know, that squeaky wheel gets oiled. So I kept at it. And they finally hired me. And so I worked there. I worked my regular job. And then I worked there in the evenings, probably 3 or 4 times a week, you know, a night for the week. And then I worked every Saturday. And I did that for like a year. But during that time, you know, I got a friend of mine a job there, her daughter. I got my youngest daughter a job there. So it was kind of nice to be able to have a little bit of pool for other people that needed a job too at the same time. Mm-hmm. But then they started offering overtime again. So I told them, I said, well, I got to go because I can't turn down this overtime. And so I quit that job. But while I was working there, I had an interest in esthetician work. I thought, maybe I'll go to school for that. I got to looking online, and as I was looking for esthetician schools, I came across something called polarity, and I didn't know what that was at the time. And this was, New Age has been started a long time ago, but this was part of it, I think. And polarity, for people that don't know, is basically body work that you move the energy through the body, through the chakras, the different frequencies, the flow of your body. And it's basically, you can do massage, but it's not a lot of muscle manipulation, but it's more just hands-on and getting the energy to move in certain areas that you feel that is congested. So I thought, well, that's kind of cool. So I signed up for a session and I went and had an experience with that and I really enjoyed it. It was better than a massage at that point. And like anything else, it depends on your technician that's working on you and if you mesh with that person energetically, you know, it's just one of those things. Well, I liked it. So I went to school and got my certification in it and I had my own business for 7 years. Then I retired and I still continued it. I worked out of my home for a while. Then I decided to sell my home and buy a freestanding condo. And when I moved into my condo, you weren't allowed to have a business running out of it. So I just went ahead and shut down my business. And so I haven't done that for a long time, but I still stay up on self-care a lot, just at home with my own stuff. When I did retire, which was in 2011, I did a lot of traveling at the time. So my friends that lived here had moved to Germany for his job. And so they told me, they said, hey, while we're over here, why don't you come while we're here so it'll be cheaper for you to travel here? And I said, okay. So booked my flight, and actually I flew out on 9/11, not on, you know, 2012, but 9/11. So at least everything went okay. And so I went to Europe for about 3 weeks and visited Paris and all around Germany and Italy. Had a great time. It was a great experience. I went during Oktoberfest, and that was an experience of its own. It's like a whole different universe there. And I was doing some traveling. You know, they moved back from Munich like the following year, and they moved to California. So I started traveling to California a lot, visiting with them. And I was getting ready to go to Hawaii for a retreat in 2020, and that got canceled. And we all know why that got canceled. COVID. So I didn't go to Hawaii. Not that I really care about Hawaii that much. I'd rather go to the British Isles. That's always been my dream. But since COVID, I haven't traveled outside of the States. I spend most of my days now, you know, trying to educate myself a lot with, you know, Alan's books and his talks and your knowledge, and just talking to you. And I love my plants. I don't know if I really have a green thumb, but I really love them, my house plants and my hummingbirds and stuff like that. And I try to, you know, do as much as I can for others since I do have a little bit more time. But in the meantime, my sister passed away in 2011. My mother passed away in 2020, and it was not from COVID. She had Parkinson's. Then my father just passed away this last October in 23. He had kidney failure. But it's just me now. And I have my two daughters, which I love tremendously. And I have two grandsons from my oldest daughter. That's kind of a little bit of background on me.
I think it's interesting because, again, the conversations that we've had, I've always been struck by the consideration that you put into a life plan, which is, you know, not everybody does that. Some people just, like myself, kind of like, oh, I'll do, you know, like a hummingbird. Oh, look, it's shiny and red over there. I'll go. But you have the opportunity now, like I said, at a relatively young age to travel and relax and do different things. But what was it that ultimately led you to even discovering Alan? Because this is a process. So what was the first chink in the armor of fictional reality for you?
Probably just when I discovered Alan, you know, and it was near, it was around the time of COVID. And I'm like, how, you know, there's never been anything in my lifetime where you lock everybody down and you, you know, run lotteries to have people get the jab, you know, it's like, this is unreal.
So it was that abrupt. You considered yourself like a normal person, a normie. You're a normal woman with a normal life. And 9/11 happened, came and went. Everything that had transpired before, you just kind of took it at face value. But this happened and you said, nope, I've never seen anything like it. So that was really the beginning of your, what you might call waking up journey, was just, this is unreal.
Well, and to discover how indoctrinated and how blindly I was living my life, you know, it's like when you find out you were just a puppet, you know, just going through the motions that they wanted us to go through, And I'm like, how different my life could have been maybe if I had known more when I was younger. I probably would have never pursued the IT career. I probably would have never got married young. But I don't know. It's just, now I wonder sometimes, all right, what am I supposed to be doing now? I don't want to go work at a corporate job. I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing as far as to help humanity in any way, except for try to help and share Alan's work and your work and other individuals that are along that intellect. But I don't know. I don't know what I'm really supposed to be doing, but learning and teaching myself things.
Well, this is a conversation that we've had a lot. I mean, I think in a way, at the heart of it, it's the only conversation that you have with yourself once you realize just how much you've been lied to and how different things are to the explanations that were given. And I think my own process of starting to find out certain things is that it's a little bit of it is like having an explosion in your mind where, and you can run around, Alan might have called that, you know, from time to time, a little bit like a headless chicken. Because you're, you know, it's like, oh, and they're spraying us from the sky, you know, and then, you know, 9/11 was an inside job, and you kind of run from one preoccupation to another, and there is a temptation there always that if you can just put together the key things, like for you, if it had been 9/11, or if it was COVID, if it was the PCR test, or whatever it is that you have put together and figured out, this isn't what they say it is. And then if you can just find the language to convey that to other people, and then if enough people know that we've been lied to on such a scale, then everything will change because people will get up in arms and they'll say, oh, no, you can't lie to us this way. We demand, but it never...
Yeah, and then another thing is trying to find others that are in the same mindset or the same level that I'm at right now, and trying to discuss things with other people where you can have a good conversation with them. I did find Giovanni through one of your talks. When you talked to him one time, I was like, So he gave an email address for his own podcast and stuff. So I thought, I'm going to email him. And I did. And he got back to me. And so we finally talked on the phone. And we've been friends ever since. And you know Giovanni very well, too. And so I found him through you. And it's good to be able to talk to him and, you know, discuss certain things that's going on in life. And you know, you figure out that we all kind of have the same issues with life for the most part. It's just trying to live the truth of it, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I've learned so much from your other podcasts, from other people, too. I mean, it's just, I can't wait till you post something every week because I'm like, who's she going to talk to this time?
Well,
I learned so much about these other people, and it's like it's amazing how there's more people than you realize know what's going on. But it's like, since there's so many people that know what's going on, I don't know if we can stop it from happening, even though we would like it to end, but I don't know if there's power in the masses or not.
I believe that, you know, Alan never thought that there would be a tipping point, an awakening where enough people would just turn things around. But what we can do is we can slow it down a little bit. It's like a wrench in the gears. We can just slow it down. And then we pass information along. And we have little networks where we that we create for ourselves, where we have people that we can communicate with, truly communicate with. And that is what I like about, you know, right here and right now and doing the real histories, is because, you know, Alan, we lived remotely, and Alan's advice often to people who would email about extreme loneliness and, you know, not having anyone at all that they could talk to about what was going on, he said, well, you know, you have to learn to live inside your own head. And he said that so many times to people. You must learn to live inside your own head, live with your own thoughts, and be okay with that. But one thing that I have noticed by doing this is that it's a network. It's a humble little network, but it's real. And there, you know, not everyone that I talk to or communicate with certainly have I done a real history with. And there's a longtime listener to of Alan's in Colorado, and another listener from Colorado said, and I'll just say right off the bat, I don't know any people in every single state or every country in the world. I don't, but it's nice when it comes together that I do. And he, another fellow in Colorado said, do you happen to know anybody in Colorado that you could connect me to? And I did. I, you know, asked this other fellow if it would be okay. And they've gone to one another's houses, you know, they're not that far away, so that they can actually see each other, and they're developing a friendship. And I just got an email out of the blue from someone in Canada. I don't know if you remember that I talked to that artist, David, and he, a painter and a musician.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and I got an email from a woman who said, oh, I'm going over to their house for dinner. It turns out I live 5 minutes away from them. And I,
oh, my goodness. I mean, that's what I'm saying. There's people that's probably could be my neighbors, and mm-hmm. I don't know that they are in the same boat I am, trying to learn and grow with the knowledge that we're gaining, you know, through all this.
We need those sunglasses like in the movie They Live, if you've ever seen that.
Yeah.
You
know, yeah.
We can put them on and we reckon, oh, yeah, you listen to Alan. You're hip to what's going on. Okay, that's cool. but I think that what you're talking about finding purpose, you know, another answer that Alan gave, or guidance that he gave very often by email, is that because people need meaning in their lives, they need their life to mean something. And I think it's, you know, if you've got family, if you have grandchildren, there are things that bring meaning to you. But some people are single, or they don't have family, they don't have children, they don't have grandchildren, or, you know, there's just this feeling of, what am I here for? What is my purpose? I'm just kind of floating around with no real purpose. And Alan would often encourage people to just continue to study on your own, make your own course of study, and over time, there's no formula, but over time, a purpose can arise out of what you learn and what you discover. And with purpose, meaning can come, you know. That's like, okay, I've found a purpose, and that gives me meaning. So it's a progression, but it's also, as he would say, hopefully we're all always learning throughout our lives. And what you might call waking up to reality is the process of peeling the layers of an onion. And sometimes you cry. And sometimes you get discouraged because, first of all, you peel the layer, and then you realize, oh, there's more to go. And there can be sadness and sorrow and anger at every single level for what you don't know, and how different your life might have been had you known earlier. But I always like to say to people that it does not matter whether you come to truth when you're 70 or when you're 20. The fact that you've come to it means there's something for you to learn and to do. And that's really something to hold on to. Your purpose for coming into this information is yet to be revealed. And yet, you're already doing things and forming relationships based on new information. So don't discount that. You know what I'm saying? That's a big, you know, a friendship with Giovanni and the willingness to help people to learn what you're learning. That's important. That's part of finding purpose.
Yeah. And on the other side of that too is it made me evaluate who was in my life at the time. Mm-hmm. And that has changed tremendously as far as, you know, there are certain people I just don't associate with anymore. And I'm not saying because they're bad people or anything like that. It's just I don't have an interest in what they do anymore. Mm-hmm. It's a lonely place to be at times, but it's also very gratifying at the same time. It's weird, but it's how it is for me anyways. Mm-hmm.
I've had these thoughts before, exactly that, you know, the loneliness and the gratification of knowing. To me, there is a tremendous amount of satisfaction, and that is a good word for it. It's satisfying to understand that you've been lied to, that, you know, it's angering, yes, it is, but it's also satisfying because you can say, no, you know. I know. I know what's going on. I may not know everything, but I understand a lot. And to realize that you've come from possibly knowing nothing real, to at least having a blueprint for where to look and where to go and how to proceed, that's huge.
Well, another thing I learned from Alan was how to go and get and learn this information. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I don't think people are taught the true way of learning the truth, you know, because they want to keep that from us. But once you find out how you should sort of study or seek out the truth, it's a little easier, but it's still, you come across things and you're like, I don't know what that really means, or, you know, what is the significance of what I just learned, you know? Mm-hmm. And then you got to decipher if it's actual truth or not, you know, because they're pretty good at having, you know, rose-colored glasses on when you're trying to figure out what's going on for real. So I think that helped me a little bit, and you definitely helped me because I was confused. I'm like, I don't know where to start. I had all these rabbit holes I wanted to go down, and I get you get confused on where should you start, you know, because it can be overwhelming without it letting it, I guess, control you, for lack of words there, but it's, you know, it's hard to smile and laugh and feel good when you're knowing all this other stuff's going on, or, you know, what the truth really is. You have to find balance in that area, or I have to. Otherwise, you're just sad all the time.
There's a couple of different things in what you just said that to talk further about. And the first is what you have started to build your own library, and that's good. You have gone and found some of the more important books that Alan mentioned and referenced. Now, there's a temptation there that you want to dive in and you know, I'm going to read this one and I'm going to read that one. And I always think that The good thing is, like, to start with some of the basics. You know, there are some basic books. Quigley's Tragedy and Hope is a basic one, but it's also dense and kind of sometimes boring reading. So it's a matter of training your brain to, we're going to read. I don't need to feel bad that I don't absorb everything. I don't need to feel bad that I read a book or a section of a book, and then a month later I don't really, I'm kind of fuzzy on it, because you're training your brain. If you're not a reader, you're training your brain to be a better reader, or, you know, maybe you're even a reader for the first time, really. So there's that. And then it's also that we don't have to understand right away what's the importance of something that we learned, because it's in your memory bank somewhere. And what I discover is that certain things that you need to know or that would be useful to you, they'll come up again for you when the time is right, when it's necessary for you to know that. And I also tend to use Alan's recommendations as the skeleton, if you will, or, you know, the frame of the knowledge building that I'm making, because there's a lot of material that's put out there that is deliberate counterintelligence. So,
yes,
in a way, it's like he vetted it.
You know, I've relied on you to help me with certain areas. It's like, you know, should I go this path or that path right now? Because you lived with Alan. It's hard to find a great mind like that and to be around him every day was, I would think, a priceless education and learning.
Well,
I don't know. I think you had a pretty good handle on certain things before you even met Alan.
Well, I'll say this is that, you know, I have often thought that it was certainly a gift beyond price. There's no way to, I mean, I was just given this huge gift. That's how I look at it. And it was, I mean, it was a blessing, a gift, an amazing experience, sometimes exhausting and stressful and crazy pace, but it was amazing. It was amazing. But I also do feel that it was a gift that I didn't really merit. And a gift that I have to give back. I want to give back as much as I possibly can. And that kind of takes me to purpose and reading and learning and knowledge and so forth, is that, look, I didn't really consider that I was going to speak out ever, or make that little video when I did the Fortitude or anything like that. I just was happy to be behind the scenes. And the idea, if you would have said to me 3 years ago, you'll get a microphone and you'll start talking, I just would have thought, no, that's not going to happen.
Well, you do it very well, I'm telling you.
Well, it's just... thanks, Laura. But it's the main thing is that if you think about the knowledge that Alan had amassed in his lifetime, and he would sit down confidently, he could talk to anybody on the phone or in front of the mic or whatever for hours and hours. And before I met him, I remember one time, it might have been the record, but one time we had a 7-hour conversation.
And, oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And I would have to say, I'm sure it was mostly one-sided, but he could really just talk about things for a long, long time, and with so much knowledge and wisdom behind it. And I look at my own knowledge and say, well, it's very limited. I haven't read this or that. I don't know this, I don't know that. And so the idea of speaking or writing or doing anything was kind of terrifying. And also, I'll say this, I don't know if I've said it before, but I didn't want to embarrass him. I mean, I know, you know, he had passed away, but I didn't want my words to undermine his in any way because people would listen to me and go, well, that woman is an idiot. She doesn't know anything.
That didn't happen at all. Well, because I'm telling you, you're doing a great job.
Well, honestly, Laura, what I'm trying to say is really not about me, but it's about you and it's about everybody else, is that wherever you are, with what you know and what you're learning, it is possible for you to give that back to other people. This is what I'm learning myself right now since Alan passed away, because I was helping him and making food and, you know, answering emails or bringing in firewood, but I was not considering that I had something to give back to other people, only to Alan. And so what I'm discovering now is that I must give back to other people. And I think that purpose starts to come together for us if we just say, okay, I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer. I don't know everything that I think I should know to be speaking publicly. I wish I would have read all of these books. I wish I knew that. But it's to move past that insecurity to say, whatever my limitations are, and they may be many, I still have something to give people. And I think you have things to give people. And this is what I notice. I mean, you have a very orderly, logical mind. And then you've also accumulated some skills based on both of your careers that you pursued that I've seen, that I've been the recipient of your own knowledge and your own skills that you've acquired. And so so what I'm saying, Laura, is if you can help me as you have, then I know you can help other people. It's a no-brainer. So it's taking the focus off of the insecurity and off of the need to, life is short. We aren't going to have time. And I remember, I only heard Alan say this maybe once or twice in years, but just a few years ago, I heard him say to me, and then later something very similar on air, he said, well, we can't know everything. We can't know everything. And I thought to myself, well, gosh, I thought you did, but
I agree with that statement, because I think he's an intelligent, just a special human being. He was,
but
don't know any other mind that's.
He had an amazing mind, and but he would say, we can't know everything. We could spend lifetimes, and I have had conversations off the air with sincere listeners who they've got some gifts, and I've encouraged in one direction or another, well, you could do and you could speak, and there have been people that I was really sure could speak out, but they say, oh no, I've got a lot more reading and study to do, and I respect reading and studying and wanting to learn, but time is short and we have a window. I mean, there are a few things that I want to get into in future talks really soon, because there are some very Orwellian, because that's a term everybody will understand, there's some really Orwellian laws that have passed in Canada and in the EU on censorship, and there's some things going on in the US, and there's the big tech. I think Dr. Mercola just put out something just a few days ago, or his team did, that was really quite good about censorship. And he also reprinted a Tucker Carlson interview with Mike. I think it's the Electronic Freedom Foundation. I can't remember what Mike's last name is. But what it was just a good conversation on the way that social media and big tech are already working to ensure that we're at a place where free speech is, it's gone. You see what I'm saying? I mean, it really is gone. Mm-hmm. We just carve out this little niche where we try to say something. And I've had, I haven't publicly said anything about this yet, but my YouTube channel has just been under tremendous attack for the last few weeks from Google, who they're going back through the several hundred videos that I've put up. And so they're going back to the very first ones and putting them under the microscope and, you know, saying, okay, we pulled this one down because of such and such a reason. And I had two of them the other day that I gave really good comeback as to why their reason for pulling it down was wrong. I defended myself very well, is what I'm saying. And 15 minutes after I sent that to Google, I got an appeal denied back on both of them. Saying,
no, that doesn't surprise me, though. But
it doesn't surprise me.
You've had to
me.
Do that more, I don't know, you've done that a lot, actually.
Yeah.
Not just recently. You've had to defend yourself in the past.
Repeatedly. And it's, and I understand that because I am re-uploading Alan's talks, and his talks have always been under a special kind of microscope. You know, I mean, I get it, and I know Google is Google, but we have this idea that, well, we can put it up on this channel or that channel, but all of them are in jeopardy because eventually that window, you know, Alan talked about that window closing, and it will ultimately close. I had to be re-educated, you know. I mean, Google tries to re-educate me.
Yeah.
If you want this reinstated.
Well, I learned a lot from Elmer when you talked to him, and I watched some of the links that you had with the podcast, and it's like, whoa, you know, things you think you kind of knew, but then you got the facts, you know, presented to you, and it's like, oh, wow.
Well, so, Elmer is a good, I think, example of what I was just talking about, because he had a career as a professional photojournalist, filmmaker, and photographer. And so, yes, those are impressive skills that he has learned over a lifetime and a career. But it's his taking that and applying those gifts and those skills to be able to put what he's learning, because he's always learning something too. And I think that we can all do that. We don't all have the same level of skills. I mean, I'm embarrassed to make a little video featuring Elmer and Elmer's work because my own video skills are so crude. But there you go. I mean, we all have our gifts, so we just do the best that we can. But he's spent, I don't know how long did he say he was listening to Alan, but, you know, close to 20 years, and it's sent him down many, as you'd say, rabbit holes. I think some of them he's come out of and said, well, you know, that was a waste of time. And that happens to us, to all of us, you know?
Yes. Yes. I agree with that.
Where you'll come out and go, oops, that was a waste of time. Or somebody that you really think is genuine turns out to be a shill, or, you know, you go, well, that, you know, I just got a bit of counterintelligence there. So you always have to be careful of that. So anyway, Laura, I don't know what you're going to end up doing in this next section of your life, I should say, not last, but in this next section. But I am confident that you will come into purpose. And And it's also because you're asking the right questions. We've had a lot of long conversations about truth and why you seek truth and what it is that you, you know, if you're just seeking it for the satisfaction of, oh, I know that, that, you know, that comes with it. That comes with it, but that, you know, our main purpose is not our own self-satisfaction. It's how can we help other people by what we've learned. But, you know, what I was thinking about, sometimes I think that, totally lost my train of thought. This is why I always interrupt myself. And when I interrupt myself, I should really let myself interrupt myself, because if I don't, I've lost it. You know what I mean? Like, I'll lose it.
You didn't learn that from Alan?
No, that's a gift. That is a gift. I would be editing one of his talks, and he would talk for, he'd say something, but he wouldn't finish his thought. And I'd be editing along, and I'd go for 10 or 15 minutes, and I'd go, uh-oh, Alan, you didn't finish your thought. You didn't close that. And then I'd think, oh, I'm going to have to make him, you know, go finish that, you know. It didn't matter if it was 10 minutes later or 30 minutes later. He always finished the thought. He'd come back to the point. He never lost the thread that I heard. Which amazed me. I lose my thread all the time. But what I was, what I was really saying is that it doesn't matter when we come to an understanding of reality, as long as you're asking the right questions. And the right question is not, how do I serve myself by knowing this? Or, you know, what can I gain from knowing this? Or how do I game the system because I've learned this? If you approach it that you want to help other people, that what I've noticed is that kind of speeds the process along a little bit of understanding how you can be helpful to other people. That's a biggie. Another Alanism is that you can't wake up other people. The journey of understanding and coming into truth is an individual's process. And as he would say, if someone hasn't already started asking the right questions, then you can't help them. There's no opening there for you to get into and help them to understand anything. And so what I was, one of the threads that I lost earlier is that in our conversations, what I've noticed is that you are asking the right questions, that you aren't getting stuck at the superficial or the trivial, and you're willing to hear someone else say, well, why do you want to know that? And you can immediately, you know, either defend it or say, yeah, I understand where you're coming from. You know, see, because part of the human tendency to want to know everything, to want to have the whole mystery solved for us in its entirety, is that we think that once we know that, everything will be different, and then we'll have the ability to convey what we know to other people. But it's in jumping off the cliff, as you will, and saying, okay, well, I may sound stupid, or I may not be able to put this across in a way that you understand. That's when you actually exercise the muscle of learning how to share what you know with other people. And then you get better and better at talking. Like you said, you just figure out that there's some people that you don't want to talk to anymore. You don't want, it's not because they're a bad person, but you realize, well, I don't have any commonality, any common ground here any longer. But what you're doing there, Laura, is you're exercising the ability to know whether or not you're wasting your time.
Yeah, well, I've learned to try to look more at the big picture sometimes, or you know, not analyze everything so much, because that's my mentality, and it has been for most of my life, you know, just very methodical, just very structured, and sometimes you can't be that way to learn the truth. Mm-hmm. And you have to be very open to things that you would be like, no, that's not how it hasn't, you know, because it hasn't been that way ever before. Mm-hmm. So you have to be very open to what you learn.
So,
and then you have to know how to further, I guess, investigate it in a way, I guess, or whatever, to figure out if it is actually truth or not. Mm-hmm. That's the thing, is trying to figure out if it is truth or not.
I'm curious, in some of the reading that you have been doing lately and some of the avenues of research that you've gone down, what are some things that you're learning, you know, right now or recently that have stayed with you that have been helpful?
Well, my new path is reading the Bible. I've never in my life owned a Bible. Never was raised in that type of household. And so I got my first Bible a couple months ago, and I'm still on Genesis, the first book. And I'm just, because I'm trying to delve into it too deeply, I think, at first, and I think I need to just read it and absorb what I can, and then maybe go down rabbit holes. But as I'm reading the Bible, I'm trying to compare it to stuff that Alan has talked about as far as the Masonic side of things. Mm-hmm. And know where you can find, like, if it says something in the Bible, or there's different symbols and stuff around, you know, in the churches or in different denominations of religion, is that really where it started? Did the Masons take from that and they're just exploiting that for evil? You know, I mean, it's just, those are things I'm dealing with now, trying mm-hmm. to figure out the Bible and how, and see how I feel about it, because I'm not sure how I feel about any of it yet.
We talked about this a little bit, and I think it's good to just, you know, read it without diving too deeply into analyzing everything. It just absorb it one time through. And then you can start again. It all depends on time and interest, and we all have different things, different paths and things that we feel that we want to accomplish. But you chose to read the Catholic Bible, which is different than the Protestant Bible. It has a few extra books in there. And I think one exercise that you might find, if you know, you read straight through this, and that may make you want to read straight through it again in, say, a King James Version or a New International or something like that. Or you may say, well, I've read it through once and that's all the time and interest that I have to give it. But one thing I mentioned to you the other day when we were talking about it is, I always find it useful when I'm looking at anything to go back to Alan's books, but I have certainly found reading Alan's books to be a useful companion when I look at the Bible.
Yeah, to me, Alan's books are probably my first Bible, even though I just got the Bible a couple months ago. But I feel that Alan's books to me are, that's going to be where I go to every time to look for some answers.
Yeah, I had mentioned this to you too the last time we talked, and I ended up using a little chunk of reading. I don't know if you recall last week when we talked, I read you that section from his books about the need to smash your illusions and how you, you know, if you're really seeking truth, then there's a lot of illusion smashing that has to be done, or, you know, breaking through your own programming and indoctrination. And I read you that section and I ended up reading it in the book club thing. And to me, that's a useful section there, because he reiterates something that is all throughout the Cutting Through books, which is more and more about this ancient priesthood that have controlled knowledge down through time. And this is something that Alan said, not just about the, you know, the Christian Bible, but about, you could say this about the Bhagavad Gita or the Quran, or, you know, you can say, he would say, all of these traditions and this literature that goes along with the traditions are certainly stepping stones to higher truths. What are you seeing when you read this? What are you really seeing here? And to me, the exercise of just reading it straight through without too much depending on someone else's explanation of what the text just said, but just for yourself, what did that mean? And you go straight through it, exercises that part of your mind that can open up and that can grab a hold of some of those deeper meanings that are there, as long as you're willing to let go of your own preconceived notion. And when it comes to religion, there are a lot of preconceived notions. And this is the in that passage that I read to you the other day, that is what Alan was saying, is that these religions and the texts that go along with them have been created in part, well, it's, you know, control, but in part, it's to make everything seem so very, very different and unique, with different dogma and different liturgy, and so you've missed the point. And you will argue all day long and forever and ever until you die about what that text really meant. And you can see this whether you're comparing Hinduism to Christianity, or you're comparing Methodism with Anglicanism. It doesn't matter if they seem to come from the same religion. Once the splintering has occurred, what I'm saying is that the splintering is by design. All of the inconsistencies, or the seeming inconsistencies from version to version or religion to religion. And Alan even said something on that page, I think, what page was that, 12 maybe, that I read to you, I don't recall at the moment, I think it was page 12, but he said that this is purposely put there, because if we got together, if I, who was raised in one tradition, am talking to somebody from 5,000 miles away of a different race, And they talk about their religion that they were raised with, which is totally different than the religion that I was raised with. Will we find common ground if we're able to communicate? Can we communicate, or are these built-in differences into the religion? Are they so strong that we'd never be able to find the common ground? And he said, the priesthood makes sure that people never are able to meet up and go, aha, we've been given the same story, but in a different way. This is what it is. It's a deliberate technique of confusion.
Yeah, like I said, I refer to Alan's books all the time because, you know, he helps to guide you in how to interpret or learn this new stuff, to learn the truth. Mm-hmm. More so than anything I've ever in my life encountered.
Yes. That's there's no doubt about it that the man spoke truth. That was it, though. This is what I had shared with you the other day. The priesthoods across the known world were international. They gave differing names for the same Trinity. In this way, tribes or nations could be kept separated, each fearing and warring with the next. The priests gave them differing languages, further confusing them, ensuring dialogue between peoples did not occur. Because, as Alan wrote, it would have been disastrous for the controllers if the various people were to discuss their various cultures, only to discover that they were the same. So that's it, you know, and the other part, and again, I do get on something and then I can stay on it for days and days at a time, but this is what Alan said. You've got to be willing to let go of everything. If you're really seeking truth, then everything you've got to be able to put it under the microscope. And religion, and you and I were talking about this the other day, it's easy to understand why religion is the one that is the most divisive. Because you were not raised in a religious household. You never read the Bible. And for you, it's just, and I don't want to say just, but you're saying, well, what happens when we die? And I asked you something that I have heard Alan ask people before, which is, are you looking for an insurance policy?
And that's a good way of putting that. I never thought of it that way. And now that you've said that to me, that brings light to a lot of stuff I've been reading. You know, I'm like, oh, I have a different approach to it now. And a better one, I do believe.
Yeah. So what I notice this in family where someone is, you know, that was raised in a certain way, has found a different tradition, you know, converted, if you will. And what I notice is there is a lot of back and forth that doesn't necessarily come from a place of understanding or love or compassion or any of these things that we think would be good to have when we're communicating with others, but it's simply mine is better than yours. I've purchased a better insurance policy. I'm likelier to go to heaven than you. That's really
ironic because I'm a person that doesn't believe in life insurance, quote unquote, death insurance.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. But,
I mean, that's...
Yeah, I'm not a proponent of that.
Yeah. So I think, you know, to me, the important question is right here and right now, what can we do that is useful and a benefit and good and beautiful, if you will, you know, what is true that we have that we can share with someone else and let the hereafter take care of itself without needing an insurance policy.
I agree totally.
Well, listen, we have just charged right through an hour and beyond, and I have enjoyed it. I hope it was not too painful. What do you think?
No, not at all. We had a rough start with all the technology on your end, but
well,
it's not your fault. It's just the software was messing up.
Yeah, I'll have to say that this recording, at least the sound in my ear, and hopefully it turns out okay, but this was the better experience. Once, you know, 3 hours later, we got it off the ground. This is the best recording experience I've had since that laptop died about 3 weeks ago. It's just been a nightmare trying to get it. And I think I may have done it. Yay.
Yes. Good going. I'm proud of you.
All right, Laura. I think that other people will get something out of this conversation, and that is good. And I like that. And just to close it off, it's because you were a little bit hesitant initially all those months ago, because we were going to do this last year, and then your father became ill. But you said, well, I just started to learn things. What do I have to share? But you see, there are people every single day, and thank God, every single day there are people who are going to have that first little chink in the armor of fake reality that they go, wait a minute, what's going on? And for those people who just happen to come across this, who have just started to question and just started to learn things, you know, they'll be heartened to hear that it's possible at any time in your life to pick up a book, to have a different perspective on things, to question reality, and to learn. That's the point. That's why we're here, without an insurance policy. You know, one of my favorite blurbs of all times that Alan did is called Sing Your Song and Steal Some Time. Back, I think it was February 28, 2007. I should just know that, but maybe I got it right. But he's talking there about, you know, singing your song is basically an Indian analogy or illustration of what it means to really actively live your life. And Alan would be the first to say, life is risky. And a life that is lived, a life that is well lived, is a life that has had risk taking in it. That's an important thing. And for you to say at your age, after your relatively normal life and your, you know, retirement coming out exactly like you, yeah, this is how I planned it, this is what I, you know, for you to be able to say at this point in your life, whoa, nothing, but nothing is what I thought it was, that is a risk, and it's courageous and commendable. And I, just to wrap up that other thought I started like forever ago, you had something to offer a listening audience by having the courage to say, I didn't know. I was wrong about what I thought I knew. And it's never too late to embark on the journey of understanding reality.
I agree with that. It's never too late. Never too late.
Well, thank you, Laura, for doing this with me. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Melissa. As you know, I told you, it's like, I don't know what I have to offer. I have a pretty boring life, but compared to some of your other interviews, and I'm just, but it's okay. I hope maybe people got a little bit out of it, and I wish them well on their journey for finding the truth.
I do too. It's hard. This life can be hard. And so, you know, it's good to give back a little bit of encouragement if we can. So everybody who is listening to this episode, next week I'm putting up part two with Elmer in Thailand. We just ended up doing a really long recording because, again, I had the technical difficulties and he was so far away and the time difference. So we just thought, okay, let's just have a massive conversation and then break it in two. So that is next week, Elmer in Thailand, part two. Thank you, everybody. Take care.